Okay. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final session of the afternoon. Now, if I remember correctly, and if I read my newspaper correctly, this was the week when Lord Phillips, the President of the Supreme Court, in, I think, answering questions to a committee of Parliament, explained that the United Kingdom judges are not really equipped to understand what is meant by the right to family life in terms of Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. So that perhaps underlines the challenge that may be facing our next speaker. Carol Wilkinson is the chair of the Scottish Children's Reporters Administration. The children's hearing system is, although subject to recent reform, is generally regarded as one of Scotland's success stories in the latter part of the 20th century. The topic is welfare and rights at the heart of the children's hearing system, and it may be that that points to an interesting tension between best interests of the child, which slips quickly off the tongue, and the notion of rights. Possibly question then arises whose rights are in play. But can I welcome Carol Wilkinson as our next speaker? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your introduction, and thank you for the invitation to address this distinguished audience on behalf of the Children's Reporter Administration. It's an honour to be here. I've also welcomed the opportunity to reflect upon the developments of the children's hearing system at such a crucial time in its history. And when I was given this topic of welfare and rights, I got a sort of sense that maybe those giving me that topic were not quite sure that these two concepts sat easily together in the children's hearing system. I hope by the end of my presentation you might view this a little differently if you are a doubter. In the time allotted to me, what I intend to do is firstly to give you an overview of the system to set the context for what I want to say. I then want to explore some of the changes that have taken place over the 40 years since the hearing system was established, and in particular in relation to human rights legislation. And finally, to highlight some of the challenges that lie ahead. It is remarkable to consider the longevity of the children's hearing system. Designed to serve society in the 1960s, it has survived amendments in the 1990s, tinkering in 2004, and is now being modernised with legislation passed late last year. Apart from the 2004 changes, each of the legislative changes have been designed, I believe, to support the underlying philosophy, what has become known as the Kilbrandon Principles. In acknowledging the soundness of the original report and legislation, it is important to recognise that regarding it as untouchable is not helpful, or to see attempts to update it as attacks on the system suggest a defensiveness that is not necessary. As our chair has already said, this is a system we have every right to be proud of. Society in the 1960s was a very different society to society today, and it makes no sense to have a system for dealing with children and their families that does not reflect their needs in the 21st century. It is particularly interesting to note that a system designed primarily to deal with children who offend now receives more referrals for children in need of care and protection. The vast majority of children and young people referred to the reporter are because of concerns about their welfare. And just a few stats to help you understand that. In 2010-11, 33,710 children were referred for concerns about their welfare, whilst 8,126 were referred on offence grounds. Perhaps more disturbing, 12.4% of all children referred were aged 2 years and under. The overall number of referrals is a reduction of 7.8% from 2009-10 and is the fourth consecutive year referrals have fallen. But this figure still represents 4.3% of the Scottish child population. And whilst referrals have been falling, the cases coming to our attention are increasingly complex and challenging. And if you're interested in the statistics and in the picture that's emerging, I would urge you to actually look at our annual report, which is on our website. And I'd obviously be happy to talk to people about it later. Can I now move to set the context and say something briefly about the Kilbrandon principles? And these are broadly described as four separate principles, what I'm calling welfare, unitary nature of the system, appropriateness of the forum, and informality. Let's start with the welfare principle. I was particularly struck when I moved from working in public services in England in the mid-90s to work in the public sector in Scotland by the commitment to and support for public service, the wide range of services still delivered by the public sector, and the focus upon welfare. The 1960s are often seen as the pinnacle of welfare, and from the 1970s onwards, we see the beginnings of a move towards a rights-based approach, and I have to say, more punitive attitudes towards young offenders. Scotland, however, has for the most part held on to its welfare approach, seeing this as the best way to improve children's lives. Our approach aims to put children and young people at the centre, but this is not at the expense of ignoring others. This does, of course, create tensions, which we will return to. And of course, if we are not careful, welfare can turn to paternalism, what I would describe as doing for and at people rather than with them, the we know best approach, which assumes that professionals have all the answers. Moving now to the unitary nature of the system. The children's hearing system deals with both children who have offended and those offended against. It sees them both as children who need help. They get treated in the same way with the same potential disposals. This gives the Scottish system its uniqueness. I have to say it leads to comments, questions, criticisms, and accolades, and that depends who you are and where you sit. It would be naive to think that the whole of Scotland or outside Scotland actually views this system as the best thin sliced bread, even if we think it is. But our system recognises the impact of family background, poverty, social exclusion, poor school attainment, not as excuses, but as factors in a child's experience. And if any of you were fortunate enough to attend the recent Kilbrandon lecture, and here Sir Harry Burns, the Chief Medical Officer for Scotland, describes some of the work that he's been doing over the last few years to look at some of the biological influences upon children and some of the impacts upon environments and upbringing in terms of children's ability to thrive, I think can actually see some of the benefits of the system that we have here. Kilbrandon's starting point was that courts were not the best place to determine outcomes for children and young people. Judgments about good or bad parenting, how best to help children and their families, are best overseen by well-trained laypersons from the communities they serve. And this is about the appropriateness of the forum. Panel members come from a much wider spectrum than is the case for judges and sheriffs. And actually echoes, I think, the point, Chair, that you were making a few minutes ago. In developing a system that's described as informal, this is not to confuse it with a lack of due process. When it works well, it allows for discussion, the involvement of the family and the child or young person, helps everyone in the room to identify the important issues, what help might be appropriate, and allows for the best decisions on the disposal and the best ways to help that child or young person. This, I would argue, is welfare at its best, not paternalism. Kilbrandon, then, is the bedrock of our children's hearing system. But as I said earlier, it should not be and has not been immune from change. So let's now look at some of the changes to the children's hearing system. And I want firstly to draw upon three particular changes influenced by human rights legislation, cases that I think challenge the welfare versus rights debate. But perhaps these cases also illustrate that at times we may have strayed more towards paternalism than welfare in our approach. The first case is McMichael versus UK, 1995. This case, put simply, revolved around the parents' right to have access to the papers being put before the panel. And it's probably a bit surprising in 2011 to even think that these were debates that needed to be had. But in this case, Mr. and Mrs. M argued that their rights had been violated as they were unable to see panel papers, and this affected their ability to participate in the hearing and influence the outcome. In summary, they could not be given a fair hearing. The European Court held the view in this case that Mrs. M had not had a fair hearing, and this particular case paved the way for parents having access to panel papers, and this is now common practice. The second case I want to refer to is S versus Miller, 2001. This was a test case in terms of children's hearings being compatible with ECHR. Again, the issue was one of the right to a fair hearing and was raised both in terms of access to papers and to legal aid for children and young people. And the outcome was to hold that access to legal aid and to panel papers supports the right to a fair hearing. I would argue that both these cases support the fundamental principles as enshrined in Kilbrandon. If we want panel hearings to involve in a meaningful way parents or carers, children and young people, so that they can participate in deliberations and decisions, then making sure they have all the relevant information is essential. And once a judgment had been made that the fair hearing for parents meant that they had to have access to papers, there seemed no justification for denying children and young people access to papers. And indicates, I think, that in thinking that parents and children could not handle access to papers, for me, implies a paternalistic approach. The third area of challenge centred around the issue of relevant person. And this was the case of PR versus K and others, December 2010. K was an unmarried father, and his challenge centred around the scope of family life. And this decision in this case broadened the definition of a relevant person, particularly of fathers, but also of grandparents. And it's interesting in terms of who's a relevant person in terms of having a right to be heard, a right to appear at panels and to be involved in the decision-making. And in fact, this is still very much a live debate. It was a live debate during the passage of the current legislation and is now being argued out through the drafting of the secondary legislation. And it does have some implications, which I'll come back to in a moment. And finally, in terms of changes, I just wanted to say something about the role of the reporter in the context of European Convention compliance. And to start by saying something about what the role of the reporter is. He or she is there to support a fair process. They provide customer care by making sure that people are put at ease and that everyone in taking part in a panel hearing actually can do that to the best of their ability. They do have health and safety responsibilities in terms of identifying risks, because as you can imagine, families who come to panel hearings are often very anxious, very stressed, they're very worried about what's going to happen, and that can actually have implications for how they behave in the hearing. And it would be naive not to assume that some parents are extremely difficult. and therefore the reporter does have responsibility to help manage the hearing in terms of reducing some of those risks and working out ways with the panel members of how to manage hearings to everybody's satisfaction, to try and avoid, if at all possible, people being excluded from hearings. And finally, they have a responsibility to provide a report on proceedings. What the reporter must not do is act as an advisor to the panel. This doesn't mean that he or she can't give a view, but they must not be seen in any way to be influencing the outcome. And they must not have excessive contact out with the hearing with panel members. Some people I know have had major concerns about what are seen as major changes to the role of the reporter in hearings. This, I think, is to overemphasise what has happened. Essentially, what SCRA has done has clarified the role of reporters in order to ensure compliance with human rights. The reporter can offer advice or guidance to the hearing, but this must be available to all parties. And that seems to us to be appropriate and to be fair and to be proper. Kilbrandon envisaged children and young people at the centre of the system. And though, as I've tried to indicate, we have made some progress in giving children a voice, we still have a lot of work to do. Over the past year, SCRA has been involved in a project to increase the engagement of children and young people in the hearing system. We have taken onto our staff several young people who have direct experience of care. And that in itself is not without challenges. They are undertaking modern apprenticeships so that at the end of their period with us, they will gain qualifications. As part of their role, we have asked them to inspect our office premises, including the hearing rooms, to go and visit our offices and evaluate their friendliness towards children and young people. How do staff in offices meet and greet them? And we've asked them to look at the information and literature we provide to see how child-friendly that is. And I must pay tribute to Glasgow City Council, to Who Cares and to Scottish Government for actually supporting us and helping us fund this work. I don't think it will surprise you to know that the report that the young people have done, which is called Fit for Us, Making Our System Fit for Children and Young People, hasn't come up with actions and recommendations for improvement. And in fact, their action plan contains 15 actions. What they tell us is that in some areas we are better at involving older children, but in others better at how we deal with younger children, but we're not consistent. For instance, if you go into our hearing rooms, you'll often find them equipped with lots of toys and things to play with, but they're all tend to be geared towards younger children, and we haven't thought about how we cater for older children. As a result of the work, we've produced a range of leaflets and a DVD aimed at different age groups to help explain the children's hearing system and to help them participate. So it gives families and children and young people an opportunity before they come to a hearing to actually get an idea of what a hearing is like. Having seen that DVD, I actually think they are materials that will be very helpful, not just to the families, but to all the professionals involved as well. Because I don't think we should make an assumption that professionals always come to the hearings well prepared or focused on the task in hand. I now just briefly want to say something about the new legislation, the Act that was passed late last year. For me, there are two key aspects to this new Act. Firstly, I believe very strongly that it is designed to improve and protect a system that is seen as basically sound, that actually does recognise the welfare and the rights of children and young people. And secondly, and importantly, it's designed to recognise and ensure compatibility with European legislation. Now, it won't surprise you to hear that the Act does have some critics who are concerned that perhaps we have increased within the system an adversarial approach by introducing legal representatives for parents and a possibly enhanced role for sheriffs. Those who seek to reassure the critics, like Professor Norrie, remind us that this doesn't necessarily mean a confrontational or court-based approach. The essence is the right to a fair hearing. He also suggests that it is utopian to think that there aren't sides, and that, in fact, all people sitting in the hearing room are on the side of the family. Parents, family carers, and children can be at odds. Professionals and families can be at odds. And at the very least, there is the state versus the family. And this, I think, takes us back to our earlier cases and the importance of no one party having access to more information and knowledge than another one. In the new Act as well, there's a role of the Legal Aid Board in quality assuring legal representation, and I think that too is a positive move in terms of improving the quality of hearings. The second criticism is the view that it is an attack upon localisation, firstly by decreasing the role of local authorities, and secondly by the new power to allow panel members to sit in areas not their own. The central tenet, I believe, remains community resolution of community problems. Whilst it's clearly helpful for panel members to know about local issues, local services, possible sources of help, Scotland is a small country, and often sources of help are similar across Scotland, and in some cases very specialist help may only be available outside a panel area. What is important is that families do not have to travel far and hearings are accessible. And in the current financial climate, it is helpful to have some flexibility in the system, so in certain circumstances, hearings are not delayed or postponed through lack of sufficient panel members. Surely dealing with cases promptly and minimising delay is a child-centred approach. I also think there are issues about ensuring that local authorities' actions are compliant with ECHR, given they are responsible for designing care plans for children and implementing panel decisions. They too must not be in a position to overly influence or undermine panel disposals. I am a supporter, as is SCRA, of the new national body, as we believe it will bring improvements to the system, in particular by the adoption of national common standards for recruitment, training and support for panel members. It will bring a level of consistency not present in the current arrangements. This has to be a good thing. And I believe, again, this strengthens, not undermines, the children hearing system. Over the last 40 years, as the system has developed, the challenge has been to marry the philosophy of welfare with the individual rights-based culture of the European Convention, and to make a system designed in the 1960s fit for the 21st century. We have to acknowledge there are many conflicting and competing rights. We are not dealing with simple issues here. To be more child-centred and to give parents and family members a voice moves us from paternalism and recognises they can contribute and that this contribution is valuable and helpful. It actually recognises their rights. However, families in trouble are not necessarily in agreement over what the problems are or the solutions, and the hearing system has to balance these competing views and rights. And we should not underestimate that getting the balance right is not easy. If you've actually been listening to some of the debates about both in Scotland and perhaps more particularly in England, the permanence debate about making decisions about children more quickly, that for me is at the core of this issue about whose rights are prominent. Is it the parents and their right to look after their children, or their children's right to a family life if their parents can't look after them? You cannot boil these down to simple issues, and I don't believe either you can actually, you know, set timescales around that always. It's not ever as simple as that. So I would argue that the rights movement has pushed us in a positive direction, and in doing so has not undermined but rather improved the system, and that welfare and rights can sit side by side in the system. Can I finally now say something about the future and the challenges ahead? I was very interested in what our last speaker, Monsieur Tell, had to say about children, and I'm hoping that he's still around and I can have a conversation with him about what the sort of plans are around children for the future. And I think it's very interesting that what it says about society and country in terms of how it deals with its children. And so my first challenge is our attitude to children and young people. Why in the UK do we dislike them so much? If you trawl through last week's paper, trawl through recent newspaper cuttings, and you'll see references to yobs and to thugs. And these terms are used to describe even very young children. You may have seen the recent research across the UK done by Barnardo's, which actually asked adults about their attitudes to children. And over 50% of those adults interviewed referred to children as animals and used terms like feral to describe them. And generally, their views were negative. Our neighbours in Europe and Scandinavia are really puzzled by our attitudes. We need to change our demonisation of our children and young people if we are going to ensure that the most disadvantaged lives are improved, that they become productive citizens, and that they have their rights recognised. And this, I acknowledge, is not an easy or short-term task. The second challenge is how we deal with our 16 and 17-year-olds. We pride ourselves on our welfare approach, but increasingly we are pushing this group into the court system. And it is interesting that the current debates around the new children's rights legislation are actually talking about the adoption of the United Nations Charter for Children and Young People. This actually takes childhood up to 18 years. So is Scotland actually going to rise to the challenge and actually see children as children until they're 18? The third challenge is retaining the principles and philosophy. So whilst we extend rights, we don't actually fill panel hearing rooms with lots and lots of people, and we become more adversarial. And that is a real concern, I think, for those who are active in the system, that whilst we recognise a lot more people have a right as relevant persons to be in the room, and we actually open up legal aid and we have legal representatives, if you're actually dealing with complex situations with a large number of children, potentially with different parents and carers, the room can become very crowded and it can become very, very argumentative. And this, in a sense, could take us away from the very principles on which the system is enshrined. So that is a challenge for us to try and manage all those changes so rights are recognised whilst other people's rights are not denied. We are seeing an increase in appeals against decisions made by panels. And at one level, we have to, I think, accept that appeals are healthy. But also, we've begun in SCRA to look at this and to actually try and understand what this increase in appeals is saying. And we're clearly beginning to identify some issues which we need to address. There are some challenges in the new Act in terms of extending the grounds for referral, particularly in relation to domestic abuse. And these will be new areas that we'll have to actually work with. Probably the biggest challenge of all is truly to involve children and young people. I've talked about a number of steps along the way, but I think we need to recognise that we've still a lot of work to do. And my final challenge is about widening our influence and taking our system to others. You may well have heard some critics of the system say, if it's so good, why don't others adopt it? And we've probably all got our views about why that is. But I think there is a lot more that we can do to actually talk about the benefits of this system. We have had a bit of interest from our neighbours across the border who, in thinking about their juvenile justice system, have asked us to go and talk about what we're doing here in Scotland. So maybe there is some hope on the horizon. So to conclude, I've tried in this brief presentation to argue that welfare and rights can sit together and are at the heart of the children's hearing system. That changes to the system through legislation and ECHR challenges have improved and modernised the system. And that what we have now is a system that allows the courts to focus on legal issues and leaves the panels appropriately to respond to welfare needs. This is a system we do not need to be defensive about. We can be proud of, promote and support. It's a system that Scotland has much, I think, to offer the rest of the world. Thank you very much.
Now, I think the chairman will allow 5 minutes for questions before we finish the afternoon. Again, I would hope there's a roving microphone available and two rovers to rove with the microphone. Any questions? Monsieur Tell.
I should say my chief executive is in the audience, and I have warned him that if your questions are too difficult, they go his way.
Okay, yes, the lady there, and then Monsieur Tell. The lady there.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Foggy, and I'm the chairman of a Family Contact Centre. I don't know enough about the children's panel system, so I was wondering what you were getting at when you were talking about fathers at the beginning, and then the number of people at a tribunal. Can you tell me, or not a tribunal, I beg your pardon, a panel. Can you tell me, please, what do you do about the situation where a stepfather is more the father of the child in practical terms than the biological father, but they're both involved, and then you've got this selection of children with different ancestry. Is that what you meant by a lot of people in the room? Is that one family to you?
Yes. What has happened is that I think we've moved to a situation where the rights and the role of key adults in a family's life have been recognised. And yes, you've actually described it very well. It would mean that potentially a stepfather, an unmarried father, could be in the room. And if you had a family of several children, one mother, different fathers, or, you know, different mothers, yes, they could all be in the room talking about these children. And apart from, yes, it fills the room, it also, as you can imagine, creates tensions because these people don't always get on well together outside the room. Put them all in the room talking about their children and their... So panel members have to be very, very skilled. And I have to say, I acknowledged, you know, that panel members are amazingly good for the most part at actually managing all these, you know, difficult things happening in this quite small room, really.
Monsieur Tell.
Thank you very much. Thank you, madam, for your intervention. Very interesting for me because, as you mentioned, we are preparing an initiative on children's rights. One small question. You mentioned... But you mind the compatibility with EU legislation? Legislation you were referring to.
Sorry, I think probably I meant convention rather than human rights. I was talking about the right to a fair hearing, the right to family life, all those sorts of issues. Sorry, I may have... Yeah. Some, I suspect, I slipped in terms of misusing my terminology, so I apologise.
Yes, you're certainly not alone in that. But but I think the three examples you gave were probably all convention challenges. And I think the focus was probably Article 6, the procedural aspect. Yes. Do we have another question? Yes, we do. Mr Gunn, possibly?
Dan Gunn, Scottish Police Service. I was interested in your reference to 16 and 17-year-olds, and I remember the debate, I think it was around 2001, when Lord Wallace, who is in the audience, may wish to comment, but I remember it was very close to being put through in an act that 16 and 17-year-olds would go primarily to the hearing system, and there was a lot of opposition to that, and the idea was dropped, and it's been mooted periodically ever since. Do you sense that there is political impetus at the moment to focus again on the issue and to take these 16, 17-year-olds out of the criminal justice system?
I don't know how optimistic I am. I think there's an opportunity with the current debate around children's rights, but and you know better than I do from your past experience that this is a very sensitive issue, and because of the range of things that 16 to 17 year olds might get up to, there might be some sympathy at one end of the range and absolutely none at the other. So I'm not sure how optimistic I am, but at least there's scope for a debate again about it. And I don't know if anyone else in the audience who's close to this might want to say something about that.
Right. Sheriff Fowles, and then Sheriff Mackey, and then probably I think the chairman would want me to wind up.
I think the observation I would make as a sitting sheriff in Perth is that once children hit 16 and they get older, if there isn't a potential consequence for their behaviour, as opposed to it simply being child-centred and assisting them, the problem is a child who, I hesitate to use the phrase, is out of control, would get the impression that I can do anything I want and there is no payback. Now, in actual fact, I would suggest that in most areas in Scotland, the Criminal Justice Social Work Department have teams that are specifically targeted for the 16 to 21 age group. In Perth, we have the Right Track programme. And my experience is that myself and my colleagues, in most cases involving kids who are involved in vandalism, breach of the peace, assaults, and have entered the justice system and look as though they are potentially heading for detention, will at least initially defer once they've been convicted and place them on the Right Track programme. But I think there is a danger that if you extend the age to 18, then in fact you will have some young people who by that stage have in their mind there is no consequence for their behaviour and will be involved serious behaviour.
Right.
And it's a question of balance, of course.
Do you want to respond or will we go?
Well, I mean, I guess the really big challenge would be to try and address the needs of these children before they get to their 16, 17, and actually, I mean, there's a lot of work going on around early intervention, and that's obviously what we'd prefer to do is deal with them when they're earlier and much younger.
Sure, Mackie. I see you're demonstrating the command of technology that we in the Scottish judiciary pride ourselves on so much.
Developed a worrying record of violent offending. The change that I would welcome in relation to that age group would be a means of the sheriff being able to maintain a degree of supervision. In the community payback order legislation, there is now built in a provision for review hearings. And it seems to me that for that age group above 16, where the young offender is on the cusp of a career in adult offending, there is a role for the sheriff to play in either overseeing his progression after the conviction or dealing with any failure of the supervision requirement, because at the moment there is no real equivalent to a breach process, which I think to some extent would meet some of the points that my learned colleague has raised here. But that would at least enable a young person of that age group to receive the more concentrated support that the children's hearing system can offer, but nonetheless maintain that the prospect of a revisit to the adult court if that breaks down.
Well, I think I'm going to be disciplined on this, and we'll bring the afternoon to a conclusion, but not before on your behalf, my thanking Ms. Wilkinson for a very informative and a succinct exposition of the what Scotland has to be proud of, but pointing in directions where improvement is possible. So thank you very much indeed. Now, that ends the conference for the afternoon. Members of the association will, I think, stay in this room for the annual general meeting. There will be, I think, a short council meeting after that. We're all invited to a reception at 7:30, courtesy of Fife and Forth Valley Community Justice Authority. That will be followed by dinner at 8:00. And I understand that we will be dining either in this area or the area just next to it. So we'll see each other at 7:30. Thank you.
Thank you again.